Good afternoon and welcome to the Thursday, May 21st, Department of Health COVID-19 telebriefing. Today, we'll have two Department of Health epidemiologists present on how the state collects, maintains, and publicly releases data about COVID-19 deaths. I am excited to welcome Kathy Wasserman, PhD, MPH, state epidemiologist for non-infectious conditions with the Washington State Department of Health, and Katie Hutchinson, PhD, MSPH, Health Statistics Manager, also at the Washington State Department of Health. Katie, you can go ahead and please begin your presentation.
All right, thank you. I want to make sure, can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay, thank you. So I want to cover three main points today. I want to introduce our process for identifying deaths and how that came about. And to talk specifically, more specifically about how we identify the COVID death, and then to discuss some of the key issues related to our process. So our method that we use gives up-to-date counts related to COVID death is not our usual process for how we track data for deaths in Washington. We had to modify what we normally do in order to quickly meet the data and informational needs of the pandemic response. We're aware that there is some confusion about how this works and whether or not this modified process is accurate. So I'm going to work to explain our normal system, our modified system, and then to help clarify any lingering questions that there might be about our death data and how we're producing the information related to COVID-19. So our goal from the very beginning of the outbreak has been to get our data out as quickly as possible, to provide information in as near real time as possible, even if the data are preliminary. Given the complexity of the outbreak, our data and our data systems, this really has not been an easy task. The decision to provide our data in near real time was initiated very early in the outbreak to ensure that the most current information was made available so immediate decisions could be made to protect the health of Washingtonians. Providing data in near real time is not our normal process and presents a number of challenges. I do want to clarify that because we provide the data in near real time, and I'll talk about more what that exactly means, our dashboard numbers do include any death to a person that is tested positive to COVID-19. So when we talk about near real-time information, similar to our case identification, we have been releasing death information within one day of being aware or notified of a death. So particularly for deaths, releasing this preliminary data this rapidly is really not our normal practice. Our normal process releasing final death data, which I'll explain in a few minutes, takes up to 18 months from start to finish. We also found that in the early stages of the outbreak, medical certifiers were really not aware if their patients had COVID-19 and did not have a clear understanding of how to complete the death certificate accurately for COVID deaths. So because of this, we implemented some processes to connect data from multiple data systems to try to identify deaths to COVID cases as early as possible and to work with certifiers and local health jurisdictions to understand which cases were dying. Over the course of the outbreak, we have been very aware of a small number of deaths being reported on our dashboard that end up not being due to COVID. I will describe these deaths more specifically in a few minutes, and we will be removing them over time from our death count. This is part of our regular process for reporting preliminary information. We know that the quality of information naturally improves over time, and that will allow us to improve our death count. Ultimately, as I will describe in a little bit, we suspect that we are actually more likely to be undercounting deaths than overcounting them, which will become more apparent once we walk through the process for how we identify death. And I do want to make clear that, you know, based on our normal process for how we process deaths and death data information and look at data quality, it may take up to a year or more to get final counts on COVID-19 deaths. So with that, I'm going to move into just trying to understand and explain better our process for identifying COVID-19 deaths. A lot of this is based on our normal process for identifying and registering and then reporting out death records. Death registration and data reporting is very complex. It involves multiple partners and multiple data systems. Registration of a death is legally required within 3 business days, but records can be registered late or within complete information. And in general, it takes up to about 18 months to do data cleaning and obtain the full information on a death certificate, depending on the complexity of a death. And this is true for the cause of death information as well. And because of this length and of the normal process, it really is unfeasible to use this for reporting COVID-19 deaths, particularly if we have to wait for complete cause of death information. So our process for identifying COVID-19 deaths basically speeds up our regular process, but cuts out much of the data quality processes. This creates the benefit of, you know, increased timeliness. We can report within a day, and transparency because we're reporting the information that we have, but it does create other issues with regards to how much information we have available on the death. So first I'm going to talk about the process, and then I'm going to talk about the issues. So our process for reporting a death is kind of a multi-pronged approach. We know a death happens. In our regular processing of a death certificate, we have 2 systems, the electronic death registration system, which is the system that funeral homes, medical certifiers, and local registrars use to fill out the information in order to complete a death certificate. That information, once approved, enters into our vital records data system, where it is complete. So as this relates to our COVID process, we know a death happened. The death certificate will get started in that in our EDRS system. And on the day that it shows up in our EDRS system, the minimum amount of information, we have a name, we have a date of death, and we have a date of birth for that death. On a daily basis, we link that information to our communicable disease data system that houses information on all cases, for all our COVID cases, our confirmed COVID cases. So on a daily basis, we're linking that information. And so I want to reiterate that our information in EDRS is preliminary, not final, and is kind of the processing zone for death certificates. Death certificates are not final. The information is not final until it is approved and officially registered in our vital records system. This process can take days to weeks to happen. So when we do this linkage to our communicable disease system, we are able to identify then that we know a death has happened to a positive case. And this is irrespective of whether, you know, whatever the cause of death is. What we do is we send these death counts to the local health jurisdictions the next morning to alert the local health jurisdiction about a death that might have happened in their jurisdiction. And we work to reconcile those numbers with what the local health jurisdiction is aware of. Those deaths after that reconciliation are then reported on the dashboard the afternoon of that next day. So there's really about a lag of 1 day before a death might be reported in EDRS. So we also, that is our primary route for identifying a death to somebody who has tested positive to COVID. We do also have some instances where the local health jurisdiction learns of a death and will report that in our communicable disease tracking system that this case died. That information may not yet be in EDRS, but they are counted in our daily counts and are reported out. So that is our basic process for identifying a death to somebody who has tested positive for COVID. We do understand that there are some issues with this process. So we don't always know the cause of death for a death when it is first reported on our dashboard. That is true. Over the course of the outbreak, we have been monitoring and recording the causes of death as we identify them in as we report them and as we know it. We currently do have some deaths that are being reported that are clearly from other causes. We have about less than five deaths that we know of that are related to obvious other causes. In this case, they are from gunshot wounds. We don't have any deaths currently being reported that is anybody who died in a car crash or any other sort of accident. The complexity arises, though, when we look at, we have approximately 20 to 30 deaths that are harder to definitively rule out. These deaths do not have COVID listed on their death certificate as a cause of death, but they list other things such as Alzheimer's disease, cancer, stroke, renal failure, and many of these conditions, COVID-19 could easily be involved or hasten a death. And so it's unclear whether COVID played a role in these deaths. We're reviewing these deaths along with the local health jurisdictions to try to assess and understand the role that COVID might have played in the death. We also have a number of certificates where it's really unclear at all what the person died from, which is a normal process with how death certificates are filled out. They might start out with a somewhat non-specific cause of death, and as more information is learned, an amendment is made to the death certificate and more specific information. So we currently have a number where it says unspecified natural causes, for example. Again, for these deaths, we really aren't able to make a determination on whether they died from COVID or not. And so one of the things to also understand about this process of looking at cause of death is that our normal process takes months and can take up to 6 to 12 months to do and to figure out and to get clarification on a cause of death. So the other thing that we have with this process is that we're currently reporting only deaths that are identified to a COVID positive case. We have a number of deaths, and right now it's just under 100, where the death certificate indicates that the person is COVID-19 or probable COVID-19. And we've not been able to link them to a positive case in our disease tracking system. So we're not able to definitively rule them in or rule them out. The other issue with this process is that we have no way of identifying deaths to people that were that could be COVID-19 related, didn't either have a test, were not suspected to be of COVID-19, and so their death certificates do not indicate COVID-19 on them. This is a particular issue early on in the outbreak where a death certificate might have something like pneumonia or acute respiratory distress syndrome, and the certifier was unaware that the person could have been COVID positive. So it's unclear. We currently in our system, we have about 3,000 death certificates that indicate symptoms similar to COVID-19. Unclear whether any of these could be COVID-19 related. So that covers our basic, process for how we identify and report out our deaths and a number of the issues that are identified there. And so one of the things that I do want to try to, make clear is that there are a number of nuances to the data that we report. And often it is very difficult, especially quickly, to make an assessment on the cause of death. So with that, I think I will leave that there, and perhaps we can move to questions.
Thank you, Katie. I did receive a note that Kathy may be having trouble with her audio connection, so we'll see if we can get that squared away. In the meantime, we'll use the remaining 15 minutes to answer Q&A. Those of you who are able to get briefing questions in ahead of time, receive 7, so we'll try and get through as many of those as possible. And if we're unable to get to your question, we will be sure to follow up with you by email. To begin, we will start with Hannah Scott, Cairo Radio. Hannah, you're on mute.
Thank you so much. Thank you for all of this information. I had a couple of follow-ups. One, you mentioned the 3,000 certificates where you can't confirm whether this is COVID. Can you just kind of just add to that, are those all included in our current death count, or are those set aside somewhere? And then why not separate the deaths as they're reported into maybe two categories, where you've got confirmed deaths from COVID and then probable deaths from COVID?
So, yes. So regarding the first question about the 3,000 deaths, so we have 3,000 deaths that are in our death certificate system that list things like acute respiratory distress syndrome, pneumonia, all things that are often related to cause of death information that is put for a COVID death. That is not unexpected. A lot of, you know, similar to, you know, any year that people, you know, pass away. It could be related to influenza. It could be related to anything. So these are just, you know, particularly given the COVID situation, it is possible that some of these could be COVID deaths because of, you know, it's just hard to distinguish whether it's COVID versus anything else. But no, we are not counting those deaths in our death counts. It's just something to be aware of and that we're looking into because it could, you know, be a part of, you know, that we're not capturing the full scope of the death. And your second question, I think, was about reporting the various numbers. Yes, so we are really trying to figure out how best to report out the information on the COVID deaths in a way that is more understandable and still as accurate and as in real time as possible. And so we're working on some decision trees to try to, you know, make that more transparent in the processing of how our deaths are processed.
All right. Next, we have Jerry Kornfeld. The Everett Herald. Jerry, you're unmuted.
Thank you. I wanted to, I guess, two questions. First, to go back to the follow-up, those 3,000 that you say is possible, some of these could be COVID deaths. Will you be investigating each of those, and could they at some point be added in? Similarly, with those just under 100 deaths where the certificates say COVID-19, but they had no link, could those also wind up at some point in the final total? And then secondly, the you used a confirmed lab test to determine, but do you also now, are there guidelines now where you could, where I don't know if it's like heavy suspicion, are the guidelines changing where you can include a COVID death even if you don't have the positive lab test?
So, yeah, so I'll answer the first one on the 3,000. So, looking into these 3,000, there's a number of ways that it can be done. And I think that's what we're trying to explore right now, is this information above what we would expect in a normal year? If it is, are there specific time periods that it's above what we would normally expect in a year? And might that help us to narrow down where we might want to look into it? With regards to the 100 deaths that we do have that list COVID on the death certificate, so that gets into some of the distinction about how to define and report out COVID cases. And there are some guidelines out there provided by the Council for State and Territorial Epidemiologists on reporting confirmed and probable cases. And if Kathy is on, I will let her respond to that if she's able to.
Yep, I'm on. Can you hear me?
Okay,
Corey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So as Katie mentioned, the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists has published a what we call a position statement for reporting and classifying COVID-19 cases, and included in those cases would be the death, and that's a complex definition, and we're working to operationalize that right now. We need to think about things like what type of testing was undertaken, what results have we received, what are the clinical symptoms, or are there clinical symptoms? Is there what we call an epidemiologic link of that death in this instance to other known COVID-19 cases, and of course what's written on the death certificate. So we're working on operationalizing that definition right now and determining how best to report out on those cases.
Next, we'll go to Sandy Dalton of the Seattle Times.
Hi there. The question that I had is about infections. Is that something either one of you could address?
Could you say a little bit more about what your question is? Not sure I understand.
New infections statewide seems to have plateaued for almost a month. So I'm wondering what you know about who is getting infected and under what conditions. And from that information, what sort of pathway do you see for reducing the number of new infections in places like King County, where the rates are remaining relatively high, without imposing new restrictions?
Hi, Sandy. I think your question will be the best suited for our communicable disease epidemiologist. If you could send that in by email, we'll connect you with them for an answer. Thank you. Next, we'll open the line to Ariel Dreher with the Spokesman Review.
Thank you. I was curious if either or both of you could talk about if there are standards or policies in place to go back and test someone posthumously for COVID-19. Is that something state officials would be in charge of, or is that left to local decision makers like the medical examiner? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that question. So the decision about whether to perform COVID-19 testing posthumously falls to the local medical examiner or coroner. And the Department of Health did issue some guidance for medical examiners and coroners regarding COVID-19 testing in early April. We also included that guidance when we sent out test kits to all the county and coroner and medical examiners across the state, with the exception of King County. We sent those out in early May, and we didn't send any to King County because they already had test kits. So I think that addresses your question. It's a local decision.
Next, we have Steve McCarron with Como. Steve, you're on the line. Do you have you, Steve?
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, loud and clear.
Okay. I had two questions, and I wanted to clarify something just to make sure I understood it correctly. So there was discussion about cases that clearly had different causes. I think it was said that there was less than five that had something to do with gunshot wounds. And then approximately 20 to 30 deaths that are a little bit harder to definitively rule out, but they apparently didn't have COVID-19 listed on their death certificate. Are those specific numbers listed within the total count right now in what we're seeing on the dashboard? And then the other question that I have is, I know it was explained that, you know, this entire process of reporting is complicated. What do you tell the general public about being able to trust that number that they see reported on the dashboard every day and making sure that it's accurate?
Yeah, so this is Katie, and I can respond. I'll start with your first question about the five, less than five cases that are gunshot wounds and the other 20 to 30. So yes, those numbers are currently reflected in our numbers that are posted up on the website. Our current dashboard reflects anybody that has died from COVID, irrespective of cause of death. Those numbers will be adjusted. With respect to trusting in numbers and accuracy, I think that this is a case where we have a commitment to putting out the best and most current data that we have. And with any process, that data, particularly as you're, you know, bringing it in a rapid manner, there is a variation in the accuracy of it. In general, particularly for the information that we have with deaths, it is fairly small variance. And that variance decreases as time goes on and we get more information added into, our stockpile of information that we have, and we're able to clarify and clean the information. I would say that currently with, you know, we're reporting just over 1,000 deaths. I would say that we have currently about a 3% variance on that. So if we were to take our 30 deaths that we have that are questionable, that we have about a 3% variance on that. And that is actually really quite excellent considering how death certificates are processed. And so I think, Kathy, you can provide additional, you know, thoughts and comments. But the information that we provide really is, I mean, it's the best that we have for that, for what we're putting up.
Yeah, I think you said it very well, Katie. I think, you know, there's a commitment to transparency. There's a commitment to provide data as rapidly as possible. And we have to balance that with our commitment to accuracy. So the data that we are publishing on our website every day are the most accurate data that we have on any given day, and with the intention to be extremely transparent and make the information as understandable as possible.
Next, we have Jacob Greneman, the Clark County Today. Jacob, you're unmuted.
Thank you. I had a question regarding the tracking that you guys so overviewed for us earlier. With regard to that tracking, can you speak a little bit to how it maybe differs from how you guys track flu-related deaths in other years, if at all, and if it is different, why and how?
So I am definitely not the person to speak on that. We do have a flu program that would be much more able to speak on how flu deaths are tracked and reported.
Hi, Jacob. This is Corey. We will connect you with our influenza program and the PIO there to answer your question. Thank you. Final question today comes from Ashley Gross with KNKX.
Hi. Okay, great. Thank you. So I have two questions. The 3,000 where the cause of death is similar to COVID-19, do those date back even before the very first, you know, official COVID-19 death? And then second, could you speak to the importance of knowing the actual number of people who have died from COVID-19 in terms of the mortality rate of the disease?
So with regards to the 3,000, yes, I mean, that 3,000 is starting from January 1st. We looked at, you know, 2020 data, did a analysis of the cause of death text information to look for, you know, keywords. And that includes, yes, you know, well before we had identified, you know, the first case in Washington. So, yes, and again, you know, just to reiterate, it's going to be extremely hard to figure out if any of these were COVID related. And so we're trying to, yes, work on that. And with regards to, you talked about the importance of understanding can you rephrase that for me?
Oh, sure. Like, why is it important that we know how many people, the actual number, you know, in terms of understanding how lethal the disease is?
Katie, do you want me to respond?
Sure. I mean, yeah, I don't think that's a hard one to respond to, but yes.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I think Katie would say the same thing, is just that we want to understand as fully as we possibly can the impact of COVID-19 on our population, and that means we want to understand the full spectrum of disease. And, of course, the COVID-19 deaths are the most severe end of the spectrum, but we want to understand the full spectrum of disease to understand, you know, better understand who's most at risk of the disease, you know, what is, what we're seeing in terms of, you know, manifestations of the disease, and to try and take actions to prevent transmission and prevent deaths going forward.
All right. With that, that comes up to our half of the hour. I would like to thank everybody for joining today, and a special thank you to our panelists. This recording will be made available later, and that completes our telebriefing.